Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit SimplyScaryPodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. And become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening, you're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome to Season 6, Episode 23. I'm your host, Otis Gyre. In this episode, I'll be performing four spine-chilling tales for you, a hand-picked collection pulled from the pages of September 1930 edition of the iconic American fantasy and horror fiction pulp magazine, Weird Tales, the very same publication that gave writers such as H.P. Lovecraft and Clark Ashton Smith their starts, and which inspired generations. I hope you enjoy listening to my renditions of these classic stories as much as I've enjoyed breathing new life into them. You're listening to the standard edition of tonight's program, which contains the first two terrifying tales. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy an extended version of this and other episodes with twice the terror, visit SimplyScaryPodcast.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. Thank you for your support. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show is about to begin. Our first tale tonight comes to us from author N.J. O'Neill. In it, we'll meet someone regaling their friend with a story of bizarre happenings they experienced courtesy of a former university professor determined to bring fire to life. Without further ado, I present to you the Flame Fiend. Thanks, Archer. I'll be glad to join you, but with just one stipulation. And it must seem an insane one, that you don't light a fire in that huge fireplace of yours. No, I'm not joking. Call it an absurd whim if you choose, though God knows it's not that either. I was never more serious in my life. I know it's a cool evening with a wind blowing that bites like sin itself, but I'd rather face a lifetime in the eternal ice at the pole than, well, no matter about that. It isn't that I have any Eskimo complex. I crave warmth and shrink from cold more than the average man. But, well, as I said, there's no use in trying to explain it. I could, of course, but you wouldn't believe me. You'd be a fool if you did. Set it down to pyrophobia, if you like. An obsession? Well, yes, perhaps. But you needn't look at me like that. There's nothing psychopathic about it. My mind's as sound as it ever was, and as normal. And it's a wonder, perhaps, after... Oh, damn it, Archer. On second thought, I better not go. I'd only have you studying me all evening as if I were an object lesson in idiosyncrasies. Just forget that I ever mentioned any such thing. No, it's no use trying to explain. I never have yet. I'd sooner be classed as just plain eccentric than as a combination of liar, lunatic, and hophead. No, you might not, old man, but I couldn't ask even you to believe. Well, damn it, why not? After all, now that you've got my thoughts running through that channel of your hell again, it might ease my mind. As I said, you won't believe me, but at least you won't laugh at me. Besides, it should be of particular interest to you, since it has a bearing on poor old Sharples and his fate. You remember him, of course, with his deep, sunken, brooding eyes gleaming above his big beak of a nose, and his graying, reddish hair straggling awry from under that rum old skullcap. Why, of course, we were in his class in applied psychology together. Can't you still see him there on the platform, dinning into our adolescent ears the supremacy of mind over matter? He dabbled, of course, in all kinds of occult research. Dabbled isn't the word either, for it was the absorbing passion of his life. I don't suppose there have been a dozen men in the last century who had delved so deeply into black-letter lore. It was rumors about some of his experiments, you remember, that finally led to his being cropped from the faculty. He confided to me once that one of his favorite theories was that of materialization. I don't mean any spiritualist seance hokum with ectoplasm and table tapping and spirit messages, but the power of the human mind by thought concentration to summon up intangible physical forms objects of other worlds, wherever and whatever those other worlds may be. None of us, of course, took much stock in his hobbies at the time. I wish to God I had, for that might have saved me. But I'm rather running ahead of myself. After the old chap left the university, you remember, he buried himself in an old hunting lodge up in the Rockies, and there kept on with his researches. He wrote me once, about 2 years ago, a letter as curt and enigmatic as most of his lectures, but hinting that he was on the verge of triumph in some weird experiment, and inviting me to visit him whenever I could find the time. It was just a couple of weeks later that we read of the poor old beggar's uncanny death. You, of course, were abroad at the time, and may not have heard many of the details. A couple of hunters found his body stretched on the floor of his cabin, his head and throat incredibly mangled. It might have been the work of a puma or some other giant cat, so far as appearances went, but it couldn't have been, for the door and every window of the lodge were locked. In fact, there was no end of mystery and to-do about it for weeks. The thing was so inexplicable that the hunters who had found him were under suspicion for a time, but their records were clean and there was no possible motive for murder, so they were released and the case lapsed into the long list of unsolved enigmas. 3 months or so later, a business trip took me to the coast and set me thinking once more about Sharples. I'd always had a deep admiration for the old chap, and I believe that in his gruff way he was fond of me too. It hurt me to think that I hadn't had a chance of accepting his invitation to visit him, And then the fancy seized me to pay a sort of possumist call, at any rate, to visit the spot where he had met his end. It lay on a godforsaken slope in the Rockies, 20 miles from the nearest settlement. I spent the better part of a day scrambling up the rocky incline and cutting my way through festering underbrush that twined snake-like round my legs. It was just growing dusk when I finally reached the lodge, a solitary log structure bathed in a blood-red glow from the setting sun as I approached it. A single dying pine tree stood like a mournful sentinel beside the building. For the rest, the landscape was a boulder-strewn waste, with an occasional clump of bushes in the distance. The place would have been gloomy enough even at midday, and I give you my word that in the gathering shadows I felt a distinct physical chill as I opened the door of the lodge. The building consisted of 3 rooms, a large rectangular living room with a tiny bedroom and a kitchen opening off it on the left, a huge stone fireplace, fully 12 feet wide and towering to the ceiling, was built into the right-hand wall. The furniture of the simplest had been left apparently just as it was during Sharple's lifetime. There was a large plain wooden table piled high with dog-eared volumes, almost any one of which would have been evidence enough to send the old man to the stake a few centuries ago. An armchair, a few other chairs, and a battered trunk, and every item in the collection seemed to be enveloped in an almost tangible aura of sinister isolation. The other rooms were furnished in just as Spartan style, a tousled cot, a single chair, and a shelf piled high with more books were all that were to be seen in the bedroom. In the kitchen, a few granite dishes, cooking utensils, and a small shelf piled with canned food. By now, night had fallen in earnest, and I found the cabin growing momentarily chillier, both physically and mentally, and it didn't make matters any more cheerful when, playing my electric torch over the floor, I perceived several dark blotches in front of the fireplace, reminders of the unexplained tragedy whose walls it witnessed. I'd brought food with me, prepared for an overnight stay in the cabin, but at that moment the prospect was far from appealing to me. However, I wasn't anxious to tackle that 20-mile trek back to the village by dark, and then a sudden savage patter of rain on the roof helped me make up my mind. The cabin would be my shelter, until dawn at least. I found a pile of pine knots beside the cabin, and with an armful of these soon had a blazing fire, which helped to dispel the gloom. As I munched my solitary meal, the rain kept up its tattoo on the roof, and several vicious lightning flashes tore a passage through the air just outside the window. But I preferred even the storm's accompaniment to the tomb-like stillness that had preceded it. After supper, with the aid of a kerosene lamp that I discovered in the kitchen, I started on a more thorough inspection of the place, and my heart was touched at the evidences of the hermit-like life poor Sharples must have led, to say nothing of the unexplained gruesomeness of his death. I could hardly hope to find anything that would shed any light on that, of course, since the cabin had been thoroughly searched at the time. So I turned to an examination of the old man's books. I doubt if anywhere else on this continent you could have found such a library of occult lore, of sorcery and necromancy from the days of earliest Egypt down to 20th century psychic research. As the tempest fury swelled outside, I turned the pages of one Kabbalistic volume after another. They weren't the sort of thing to be fathomed at a glance, but the little that I gathered from them opened up vistas of things unseen and unthinkable that appalled me. I tell you, Archer, there are not only more things in heaven and earth than are dreamed of in your philosophy, but there are far more in hell, too, for in those printed pages I saw things hinted at that could only emanate from the deepest hell of hells. And as for what followed, Finally, between the pages of one incredible tome, a translation from an ancient Egyptian, I fell upon something of a far deeper personal interest. A pad of scribbling paper, covered with a familiar scrawl, the handwriting of old Sharples himself. As cryptic a hieroglyph as any ever inscribed on the oldest pyramids. It appeared to be a diary in which he had recorded his progress, with experiments of some sort, but so laconically that I could gather little from them. The last entry was dated, as nearly as I could recall, 4 or 5 days before the finding of his body. "Threshold of triumph at last," it read. "Tonight, final proof. Danger if control falters. Formula of Sothmi would suffice." Then I glanced at the book in which I had found the notes. From the page at which it was open, I read, "Notable among such elementals is the salamander, the spirit of fire. This being, Sothmi describes as having the aspect of a giant lizard with protruding fangs and claws." At that moment, the light of the kerosene lamp flickered and vanished, leaving the room illuminated only by the dancing rays of the fire. I saw that the lamp was empty, so I heaped another armful of pine nuts onto the blaze and drew the armchair up closer to it. I had brought the book with me, but as a particularly vivid flash of lightning stopped the darkness outside and a clap of thunder snarled in its wake, I hesitated to read on. My mind and feet seemed to be treading a dangerous labyrinth, whose tortuous windings might lead to at least madness, if not to some abyss of hell. As the fire crackled and the flames leaped hungrily ever higher toward the ceiling, I gazed into their glowing depths. Strange, I thought, that my mind should so focus on the fire when a moment before I had been reading of the mythical spirit of fire. But after all, was it so strange? That uncanny snatch of description was running through my head. The aspect of a giant lizard with protruding fangs and claws. And I tried, blind fool that I was, to conjure up a mental image of such a being. Of course, I told myself it was preposterous to sit in the 20th century of Christian civilization and dream of a creature of 5,000-year-old fable. And yet those words obtruded still on every cell of my brain. The aspect of a giant lizard with protruding fangs and claws. By now I was staring into the fire with the fixed fascination of a crystal gazer. There's a hypnotic force about a blazing flame. Archer, small wonder, I reflected, that primitive races had either deified it or at least imbued it with a personal spirit. The salamander. As I gazed into the fire, an illusion gradually grew upon me that my brain was whirling round and round in a circle, at the center of which crouched the figure the book had described, a giant lizard with protruding fangs and claws. I grant you, Archer, that was pure illusion, auto-hypnosis, if you will. But what followed wasn't. For suddenly, above the roar of the storm outside and the crackling of the fire, which had now grown so hot that I had moved my chair back from it, I heard a sound which turned me cold with dread, as no sound has ever done before or since. It was a peculiar sibilant hiss, which came to my ears as clearly as though all else had been dead silence. It wasn't unlike the hiss of an angry cobra, if you've ever heard that none-too-pleasant sound, but it possessed, too, some incredible, unearthly quality which set my head reeling with involuntary nausea. And above all, it appeared to come from the very center of the fire. For a moment I looked backward toward the door and pondered the possibility of breaking away and spending the night even in the open in that downpour of rain, if necessary. But then I got a tighter grip of my nerves and trying to convince myself, against my own knowledge, that it was all imagination. I turned to face the fire once more. As I did so, that diabolical hiss came once more, followed by a peculiar, stertorous grunting, and then, in the very heart of the flame, I beheld something gradually assuming visible form. First, it appeared to be a mist or vapor, and then, out of the mist, two dreadful green spots glowed, like searchlights playing from the very bowels of hell. Then, the mist in it seemed to settle into a solid outline, such an outline that I screamed aloud in horror of soul and sprang from my chair and would have burst out into the night, but in a twinkling, the ungodly thing had leaped straight from the heart of the flame and gripped me by the throat. Archer, this is the living truth, I swear it, as I am a living man this moment. I haven't words. Human tongue hasn't power to describe adequately that foul spawn of Satan that had materialized from thin air before my very eyes. The description I had just read, a giant lizard with protruding fangs and claws, fitted it as far as it went, but it didn't begin to picture the soul-sickening repulsiveness of the object. It wasn't unlike a Gila monster in general appearances, if you can conceive of a Gila monster, 5 feet in length, with a slimy black body and ghastly horned head, eyes that glowed alternately red and green, fang-like teeth projecting from a satanically slathering mouth, and 4 legs with claws like those of an eagle. And this unutterable horror was the thing that had torn a life from poor old Sharple's body. I realized that in the same twinkling of an eye that it had catapulted itself upon me. I was so unnerved in soul and body that a breath of wind could almost have floored me, and I collapsed like a rag beneath the spring of a monster. Then, as I found myself flat on the floor, with its ruthless talons sinking into my throat and its foul face pressed close to mine, its breath searing me like a blast from hell, despair gave me new strength. I don't know whether old Sharples was there in spirit, aiding me in my battle against that atrocity from the shades, or not, but I dug both hands into the creature's throat and twined its legs about its floppy body with the grip of a boa constrictor. Even in that hectic accumulation of horror upon horror, I experienced a fresh twinge of nausea to find that although the thing had emerged from the heart of the flame, its body was as icy cold as though fresh from a tomb. Old Dante himself, Archer, could scarcely have painted in 1/10 of its ghastliness a word picture of the struggle there in that lonely cabin, with thunder, lightning, and rain outside lending a fitting accompaniment. It seemed like hours. In reality, it can't have been 5 minutes, for no human being could have lived so long in such unequal combat. That I tossed and grappled with that awful thing. I felt in my heart of hearts that the struggle was vain, that I couldn't hope to kill or even overcome this thing which wasn't of earth. But still, with the frenzy of despair, I tore at its neck and kicked at its pulpy body as those savage talons bit into my shoulders and that unspeakable mouth with its protruding fangs hovered close above mine. Then the bestial jaws opened wider, and I knew the end was at hand, and I prayed to God, as I've never prayed before, that it might come with merciful quickness. And it did. There was a sudden blinding flash, and then a crumbling, rattling, roaring sound, as though the universe itself was falling in ruins. Something crashed on my head, and then oblivion. You probably don't believe in miracles, Archer, but I do. Ever since that night, I'm firmly convinced that it is due to divine intervention that I'm alive today. When the mists lifted from my brain, I lay in a pile of stone wreckage on the floor of the cabin, racked with agony in every limb. My first conscious thought was of that fiend from the shades. Then, as I raised my head slowly to look for it, I realized that it had vanished, and that the blessed light of day was streaming in the windows. No, no, Archer, it wasn't a dream. Here, just a minute until I loosen my collar. You'll notice that I wear it particularly high. Do you see those scars on my throat? No dream could have put them there. If those unholy claws had gone a quarter of an inch farther, they'd have torn my jugular vein open. Well, explanations are always an anticlimax, so I'll cut mine as short as possible, combining what I observed there and what I learned later from a closer study of Sharple's books. The thing that had killed Sharple's, and had come within an ace of doing the same to me, Archer, you won't believe it, I know, was literally a salamander, one of those elemental beings which form a connecting link between this world and some world beyond. An elemental, of course, is a disembodied thing, only capable of action if it can get control of a physical body as an instrument. And old Sharples had created such an instrument for this creature. Those diabolical old volumes of his contained, among many secrets, the ritual to be followed in the summoning of an elemental in material form. The theory was that by sheer concentration of willpower, an adept or sorcerer, call him what you will, could create a material body or shell for such a spirit. In case of the salamander, there were two essentials. First, the concentration of the mind, and secondly, a strong hot fire, the native element of the creature. And old Sharples had succeeded, as he dreamed of doing, in actually incarnating the monster which had cost him his life. The materialization was a limited one, as all such materializations are, thank God, limited as to place and time. The salamander was fettered, you might say, to that spot. It could only move a few feet from the flames in which it had sprung into being, and it dematerialized once more the moment the flames died. But once summoned into actual existence, probably for the first time in a score of centuries, the thing was still chained, unseen at that spot, and hence far less concentration of thought was necessary to summon it a second time. The fire and the involuntary focusing of my mind on what I had read were sufficient. Then came the miracle that saved me. At the moment when it seemed that scarcely even a miracle could intervene, in that instant, when the hell-born creature's fangs were at the point of meeting in my throat, a lightning bolt had struck the stone chimney of the cabin and had sent it crashing inward, shattering the fireplace and instantly extinguishing the flames, with the consequence that the salamander's material body had evaporated into the air from which it had emanated. That's my story, Archer, and, well, just a point or two more, perhaps. As I say, I realized later that the damnable thing was still lurking, invisible within the cabin, thirsting with all its unholy force for another opportunity of taking physical form. There wasn't much likelihood of that, perhaps, since the fireplace was irretrievably shattered, and even any wayfarer in that desolate region had chance to build a fire there, there'd be practically no chance of his turning his thoughts in a dangerous direction. But I was resolved to take no chances on it ever being loosened on human eyes again, so I did probably a high-handed and unlawful thing. A week later, I climbed that tortuous mountain slope again and laid a charge of dynamite beneath the cabin, which leveled it in a tangle of wreckage to the ground. Sharple's books I removed first, poured kerosene over them, and set them alight, with a long fuse, incidentally, for I preferred to be a couple of miles from the spot when those sinister pages flared into flame. There's nothing more to add, except that, from that day to this, I've never dared to face flame, for fear my mind, in sheer defiance of my sanity, may focus there once more and summon up some other lurking messenger from hell.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's Angie.com.
I hope you enjoyed The Flame Fiend, as written by N.J. O'Neill and performed by yours truly. Up next, we've got a second tale of terror for you, courtesy of the legendary master of the macabre, Clark Ashton Smith. In it, we'll get acquainted with Jonas McGillicuddy, a man who's been away from his family for several years. When he finally returns home, Jonas realizes a wildfire has ravaged his homeland. Fearing for the worst, he seeks out members of his family and is bound to discover that things aren't always as they seem. Without further ado, I present to you The Phantoms of the Fire. It was late summer, and the Georgetown Road was deep with dust, which had settled like a dun pall on the bordering chaparral and pines. Since he had walked all the way from Auburn without securing a single lift, the man who was trudging along the road with the broiling afternoon sun on his back was hardly less dusty than the trees. He paused now and then to mop his face with a discolored handkerchief or to peer rather wistfully at the occasional cars which passed him without offering to stop. His clothing, though not actually ragged, was old and worn, and had the indescribable shapelessness of clothing that was slept in. He was very thin, stoop-shouldered, and discouraged-looking. His general aspect was almost that of a professional tramp, and the people of the countryside were suspicious of tramps. "Well, I guess I'll have to walk all the way," he said to himself, whining a little even in his thoughts. "But it ain't much further now. Gosh, but things is hot and dry." He looked about him at the familiar landscape of parched grass, brushwood, and yellow pines with an appraising eye. "Wonder there ain't been more fires. There always is at this time of year." The man was Jonas McGillicuddy, and he was on his way home after a somewhat prolonged absence. His return was unannounced, and would prove as unexpected to his wife and three children as his departure had been. Tired of trying to extort a living from the small vineyard and pear orchard of rocky Eldorado land, and tired also of the perennial nagging of his frail, sensitive-nerved, and sorely disappointed wife, Jonas had left abruptly 3 years before, after a quarrel of more than customary bitterness and acerbity with his helpmate. Since then, he had heard nothing from his family, for the good and sufficient reason that he had not sought to communicate with them. His various attempts to earn a livelihood had proved scarcely more successful than the fruit-ranching venture, and he had drifted aimlessly and ineffectually from place to place, from situation to situation, a forlorn and increasingly desperate figure. For a man of such shifting, unstable temperament, when all else had failed him and he had wearied of the hopeless struggle, it was not unnatural to think of returning. Time had softened his memory of his wife's undependable temper, of her shrewish outbursts, but he had not forgotten her motherly ways when she was in a more tractable humor, nor her excellent cooking. Now, with empty pockets, since his last money had sufficed merely to pay his train fare to Sacramento, Jonas was nearing the hills in which lay his forest-surrounded ranch beyond Georgetown. The country through which he tramped was sparsely peopled, and there were great stretches of softly rolling hills and low valleys that had not known the touch of cultivation. The ranches were often quite isolated, Beyond all, in the hazy blue of the distance, were the vague and spectral snows of the Sierras. "Gosh, but one of Matilda's pear pies, it'll taste good," thought the wanderer. His mouth began to water. It was not reflective enough, however, to wonder just what his reception would be, beyond an uneasy surmise that Matilda might give him a terrific scolding for his absence. "But maybe she'll be mighty glad to see me after all," he consoled himself. Then he tried to picture his children, the 5-year-old boy and the girl babies of 3 and 2, respectively, whom he had last seen. "Guess they'll have forgotten they had a papa," he mused. The afternoon had been utterly still and airless, with a sultry brooding in its silence. Now, from the northeast along the road he was traveling, there came a gust of wind, and with it the unmistakable acrid odor of burnt grass and trees. "Hell, there's been a fire after all," muttered Jonas, with an uneasy start. He peered anxiously ahead, but could see no smoke above the dun and the gray-green hills. "Guess it's all out now, anyway." He came to the top of the low slope he was climbing and saw before him the burnt area which lay on both sides of the road and was of indeterminable extent. The brown foliage of heat-seared oaks and the black skeletons of bushes and pines were everywhere. A few fallen logs and old stumps were still smoking a little, as is their wont for days after the extinguishment of a forest fire. It was a scene of complete and irredeemable desolation. Jonas hurried on with a sense of growing panic, for he was now little more than a mile from his own property. He thought of the yellow pines that stood so close and tall about his cabin, the pines which he had wished to fell, but had spared at the earnest solicitation of the nature-loving Matilda. "They're so pretty, Jonas," she had said pleadingly. "I just can't see them go." "Hope the fire didn't get into them pines," thought Jonas now. "Gosh, but I wish I'd cut them down when I was planning to. It would have been a lot safer. And I'd have the money for the wood, too." The road was strewn in places with ashen leaves, with the charcoal of fallen brands, and several trees had crashed across it, but now had been removed to permit the passage of traffic. It was hotter than ever in this charred and blackened waste, for the brief gust of wind had fallen. The dust on Jonas's cheek was runneled with sweat, which he no longer paused to wipe away. Irresponsible as he was, a strange gravity had come over the wastrel, and he felt an ever-deepening premonition of calamity. He came at last to the little by-road which turned off to his ranch from the Georgetown Highway. Here he frowned with a sinking heart. The fire had also been, and had left nothing but devastation. In spite of his fatigue, he almost ran with long, shambling steps, and rounding a turn in the by-road, saw that the fire had stopped at the very verge of his own property. The hillside orchard of stunted pear trees, the straggling vines of mission and muscat grapes, were quite as he remembered them. And beyond, in the grove of yellow pines, he could see the wreathing smoke that arose from the chimney of his cabin. Panting heavily, he paused with a sense of relief and thanksgiving as poignant as anything of which his dull heart was capable. The sun had almost touched the horizon as he climbed the winding road through the orchard and entered the grove above. Aisles of light, perceptibly tingled with gold, lay between the elongated shadows. Even to the sodden, insensitive Jonas, the beauty of the woodland scene, the magic of the sunset, the high, solemn, dark-green pines, and the rich glow sifting among them on manzanita bushes and beds of brown needles, were not without their charm. He drew a long breath, inhaling the clean balsams that the hot sun had drawn from the forest, and feeling, as he did so, a vague pleasure. Now he could see his cabin, a long four-roomed shack of plain, unpainted boards and weather-darkened shingles. A woman in calico standing in front of the steps, Two little girls were beside her, and he wondered as to the whereabouts of the boy, who had been a fragile youngster, always ailing and fretful. "Maybe Bill is sick again," mused Jonas. He was very glad to be home, but he felt a little doubtful, a trifle tremulous as to the greeting he would receive from Matilda. The woman looked up as he approached, shading her eyes with her hand from the last rays of the sun which fell horizontally through the wood. He could see her apron, which was quite clean, as always, though worn and faded from many washings like her dress. She did not seem to perceive him, but was apparently staring with great intentness at something among the trees. The children also stared, and huddled closer to her, clinging to the hem of her gown. Jonas tried to call out, "Hello, Matilda!" But his throat was so dry and dusty that the words were no more than a hoarse whisper. He started to clear his throat, but the simple act was never finished, for at that moment the whole scene before him, the trees, the cabin, the woman and the children, were lost in a roaring sheet of ruddy flame that seemed to come from all sides at once and blot out the entire world and the very sky as it towered, full-grown in what could have been no more than a fraction of a second. A blast of intolerable heat, fierce as the breath of a thousand furnaces, blew in Jonas' face and swept him backward like a hurricane. The mighty roaring pounded in his ears like a sea, and was mingled with human screams as he went down into pitch-black gulfs of unconsciousness. It was day when Jonas awoke, but he was too confused for a few instants to realize that the light was slanting through the treetops from a different direction, or that there was more of it than seemed normal in an evergreen forest. When his wits returned sufficiently to permit the comprehension of the fact that it was morning, he began to notice other things that were equally singular. He found that he was lying on his back among burnt needles, and above him towered the dark boles of fire-swept trees with the pitiful stumps of their cauterized branches. Darkly, indistinctly, in a sort of dull astonishment, he began to remember the events of the previous day, his return at sunset to the cabin, his glimpse of Matilda and the two children, and the all-engulfing sheet of flame. He looked instinctively at his clothes, with the feeling that he must have been badly burnt, but there was no trace of fire on his raiment, and the black ashes about him were cold. Nor, when he reared himself on his elbow and peered around, there was the faintest thread of smoke to indicate a recent conflagration. He arose and stepped toward the place where the cabin had stood. It was a heap of ashes, from which produced the ends of charred beams. "My God!" muttered Jonas. He felt utterly dazed, and his thoughts refused to align themselves, failing to form any sort of intelligible order. As Jonas spoke, a man arose from where he'd been stooping behind the wreckage of the cabin, furtively dropping some object, which he held in his hands. Seeing Jonas, the man came forward hastily. He was a gaunt individual in dirty overalls, with the profile and general air of a somewhat elderly and dilapidated buzzard. Jonas recognized him as Samuel Slocum, one of his neighbors. "Well, Jonas McGillicuddy, so you've come back," explained this individual in raucous tones of unfeigned surprise. "You're a little too late, though," he went on, without pausing to let Jonas speak. "Everything burned up clean 4 days ago." "But the cabin was here last night," stammered Jonas. "I came through the woods about sunset, and I saw Matilda and the children in front of the steps, just as plain as I see you. Then everything seemed to go up in a burst of flame, and I didn't know nothing till I woke up just now." "You're crazy, Jonas," assured the neighbor. "There wasn't no cabin here last night, and ain't no Matilda and no children neither. It was all burnt up along with the rest of the countery hereabouts. We heard your wife and babies a-screaming, but the fire was all around before you could say Jack Robinson. And it trays fell across the road, and no one could get in, and no one could get out. I always told you, Jonas, to cut them yeller pines down. My folks was all burned up, faltered Jonas. Well, your little boy died a year ago, so there was just Matilde and the two gals. I hope you enjoyed The Phantoms of the Fire by author Clark Ashton Smith, as performed by yours truly. As a reminder, all of tonight's tales were drawn from the September 1930 edition of the legendary pulp fiction magazine Weird Tales. I hope you'll agree that even though nearly 100 years has passed since these spooky tales were first published, that some things never change, that they are just as chilling as ever. Thanks for listening as I breathe new life into these classics. I'd also like to thank you personally for joining me for this particular episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and would mean a lot to us. If you'd like to hear a premium, extended edition of tonight's and all of our other episodes featuring Twice the Terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click the Patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can purchase season passes for this podcast and our other quality storytelling programs, or become a patron for as little as $5 per month, and get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012, all of it ad-free. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyre channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back to 2014. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, too. Just search for Otis Gyre. Until next week, stay spooky and get some sleep, if you can. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories performed by yours truly, Otis Gyre. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groschek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyre channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's OTIS@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.